I'm going to talk today on basically two topics. One is a short discussion that I prepared when we did not know yet that Gary is unavailable. And it's essentially a very short discussion about the history of the book that we are discussing today, The Treatise of the Family. The second part will be basically going over the slides that Gary Becker has mailed us, and I will essentially present them and make some comments as we go along. So let me begin with the book. So first of all, this book, as how it appeared in 1981, had its origin much earlier in a sequence of papers that Gary has It's a sequence of papers that Gary has started, and perhaps without any particular plan to enter into some deep discussion of the family, but things developed. So the first paper that is relevant is the one on economic analysis of fertility. It appeared in 1960. Just to get a perspective, Gary was about 30 years old at the time. He started his career as publishing much earlier than that, so he was relatively young when he started with this particular project. But it took him time until he consolidated it. So the other paper in the sequence which is related is The Theory of the Location of Time, in which he started to think about how family operate, division of labor, and things of that nature. The main papers that is called Theory of Marriage 1, Parts 1 and Part 2, appeared in 1973-74. This is the first time where he tackled the associative mating issue in relatively full generality. A related paper, which appeared at the same time, is The Theory of Social Interactions. It's a sort of general discussion, but it's very much in the family in mind. It includes a variety of thoughts about altruism and about interdependence of preferences. Finally, in the sequence, it's a paper that perhaps should get more attention than it received, is the 1977 paper jointly done with Elizabeth Landis and Robert Michael, appearing in 1977, which is a very good empirical and analytical discussion of divorce with many ideas that today some of them are still unknown and unworked out. Now you see we're standing now in 1977, he already published a couple of papers on these problems. And now there's a gap in time until 1981. So he kept waiting. And in the introduction, he explained it, why he waited so long, because he was not sure that he fully understood the topic. And he basically gave up in 1981. He said, okay, let us put it in the public domain. Let us other work on it as well. And perhaps we'll make some further advance. Not only that he delayed it, let's read carefully what he writes about it in his Nobel lecture. Writing a treatise on the family is the most difficult, sustained intellectual effort I have undertaken. It required a degree of mental commitment over more than 6 years, during many nighttime as well as daytime hours, that left me intellectually and emotionally exhausted. Indeed, several years after that, he was a bit slow in publishing. Now, I think that this conference and several other conferences we had in the last few years, including one in Chicago on his 80th birthday, one in Barcelona, are one of many signals that although this was a huge effort on his part, it's also had a very high payoff. So this book is really important, it's really influential, and actually I'm sure almost everyone in this room was affected by it. Now, it was already pointed out that Becker developed several new areas, discrimination, human capital, crime, family. In all these areas, he encountered initial opposition. And Gary actually is proud that he was able and willing to swim against the stream. He was taking a lot of risks because fairly eminent people like Ero and Solo, for instance, did not think much of him. Okay, so it took him time, and he persisted. And the question is really not only why he's persisted, this is sort of a matter of character, but why eventually he became so influential. Now, if we focus on family economics, there's basically two big ideas here. It's the idea of competition, and the idea, namely competition in the marriage market, so to speak. Namely, people have many alternative spouses, and they don't need to marry, but they can choose, and each one has a lot of alternatives. And the other idea is, and which is a bit hard to understand at first, that we need to discuss here decision, simultaneous decision by two separate people. So it's very big departure from the usual maximization problems that were used in microeconomics. And it looks like not a big departure, but practically in trying to going to data, it's actually quite a big departure. And I think greatness of Gary's project is his ability to derive new insights. Not only new, they are often counterintuitive. So you know that people in psychology, for instance in sociology, wondered what do we gain from starting with the economic approach? What's new here? What can we learn that we did not know before? By the way, this battle with sociology is not over. A year ago, 2 years ago, when I visited with Martin in Oxford, when we were writing our book on the family, there was an eminent sociologist by the name of Goldthorpe. At lunch, we talked with each other, what are you doing? I said, I'm visiting here, Martin, we're writing a book on the family. Goldthorpe asked me, are you like Gary Becker? I said, yes. So that was the end of discussion. Then we moved to talk about birds because he's a bird watcher. So this thing is not over at all. And it's really on us to prove that something that we are doing here in this big project actually yields new results and important results. So I will give you some examples here. And I picked only a few of them, but I think that will give the gist. So the first idea is, in his discussion of assortative mating or matching, he also talked about negative assortative matching. And he noticed that in a competitive market with transfers between spouses, it is possible, and now listen, that the man considered best by all women and the woman considered best by all men will not marry each other. So this, I think, very counterintuitive, okay? I call this general idea that people would think that the king of the class will marry with the queen of the class. But with competition and transfer, it will not necessarily happen. And it does not happen whenever there's negative interaction in trade, if and only if there's negative interaction in trade. And the idea here is that in competition, basically the person who will get the best woman is the one who can bid the highest for her. And this is not necessarily the best man, and it actually will not be the best man if there's negative interactions. So what's the evidence for this? This is fairly unintuitive idea. Really what we do see is a lot of positive associative matching on schooling. This is a very strong phenomena that we observe. It may not necessarily be explained only by supermodularity or complementarity, maybe there are issues of where do you meet your spouse and so on. But in any case, this is a very pervasive phenomenon. A negative associative matching is not so common. Actually, it's not even observed. Under division of labor, this model will actually predict that men of high wage and women of high wage are substitutes rather than complements. So the model will predict negative associative mating, but it's not observed in the data. In the data, there's very weak correlation between the wages of the spouses. So here he won 1 point and he lost 1 point. The other idea, which again is counterintuitive, it's called the Rothen-Kidd theorem. For those who don't know, apparently it's named after the son of Robert Barrow. And that's how this idea goes. In family with altruistic head who can transfer to all family members, all household members act in harmony to maximize the size of the pie, the size of the pie available to the head. So this looks almost like a fairy story. Somehow it's possible to overcome all issues of control or incentives within the family under relatively weak conditions. And there was a big debate on this, what exactly are the necessary conditions, and now it's agreement, for instance, that it's almost if and only if there's transferable utility, but there's a lot of other issues there. What exactly is the game, who moves first, who moves second, who moves last, and one issue that it's not fully appreciated is that the fact that the father is altruistic, it's also a constraint. Actually, it's a big constraint because he will never be willing, by assumption, to punish his son. So this is a model without punishment, and yet incentives work. So as I said, the debate is still going on here about exact assumption required and the relevance of this result. Empirically, this is actually quite difficult to test, although many parents, I guess, feel that this is not correct because they don't see that their kids actually are so much under control as this model will predict. There's some work, and also some in this conference, which I was not aware of before, on strategic issues in this concerning bequest. And typically this data suggests that parents are strategic about bequests. In other words, if you give them care and time and visit, they may increase the bequest to you. And this is in contradiction to the assumptions of the model. A direct test, experimental test, was done by Peters. They basically made an experiment with a contribution to public account game, and they noticed that family members actually are willing to give to their family members, but they fall short of maximizing the family assets. So this is sort of an in-between result. So this, I think, right now stands that it's not so obvious how to test it empirically. The last one is a so-called Becker-Coase theorem. And this is saying something as follows. Couples who transfer resources between themselves within marriage and after divorce will not be influenced in their divorce decision by laws governing the distribution of income between spouses before or following divorce. So basically, the model says something like that. The divorce, you need here, two people are involved here, the husband and the wife. And the general rule is that if the total value of the marriage compared to the total value of both of them in the divorce state is high, then they will not divorce. If the contrast, in contrast, the value for both of them in the divorce state is higher than the value of both of them in the marriage state, they will divorce. And this is an if and only if a statement under these conditions. So in particular, it says something like that. You can imagine two Pareto frontiers, one in marriage and one in divorce. If the one in divorce is higher, divorce will occur. If it's lower, it will not occur. And it's completely irrelevant, this is the point, at which point on each of these Pareto frontiers you are. This will not affect the decision at all. Now, this is a very strong assertion. It also came in a very important time with huge changes in divorce. So people felt here the really important policy implications. So this was tested and tested and retested. And a lot of research, both on the theoretical level, but here mainly on the empirical level, has been done. And this is how these things stand from the perspective of today. There's a summary paper by Wolfers on these experiments in these papers. And what we know is indeed that just following the change in the law, there was a big change or a big rise in the divorce. And this can perhaps be attributed to pinned down divorces that could not happen before, and now they became available. So there was a very large increase initially. And then divorce continued to increase, but eventually it decreased. I'll show you in short time figures from the Becker slides on this. So if we look at all the debate, it was a big debate and a very attempt by various writers. Here is what he summarizes. Liberalized divorce law had at most small effect on divorce rate. And this reforms explained very little of the rise in divorce over the past half century and its subsequent decline. So in a big way, I think on this particular issue, a very, very surprising statement tested by very, very capable people, strong assumption, and but still it turned out to be correct. Gary is not afraid of making strong assumptions. He's aware that you need transferable utility and all this kind of thing, but he thinks that those perhaps are roughly correct assumptions, and the only way to know how correct they are is to test implications. So you can think about this result, or this negative result, which support his no effect theorem or prediction is that transferable utility is something we can work with. It's not something completely silly. It yields implications which seem to be consistent with reality. The final one, which perhaps is not so well known to this audience, is this idea that both good and bad shocks can cause divorce. First of all, why do we need shock? The issue of divorce is why someone you wanted to marry a year ago, suddenly you don't want to be with her anymore. So something had to change. So shocks, first of all, are important. Now, what type of shocks can trigger a divorce? There are quite many of them, but most people would believe that negative shocks, like someone falls ill and then you have to take care of him and so on, can cause divorce. It's less intuitive why good events can cause divorce. And here is where the economic logic comes in, and this is something only an economist would be able to say. If husband gets an unexpected winning in the lottery or increase in wages and so on, he becomes better in the marriage market. Therefore, he, in principle, can afford a better wife than he had before. So he may leave the marriage and seek a better wife. However, if he unfortunately breaks his leg and loses his job, which is the bad event, his wife will break the marriage and find another healthy spouse. So this look at this competition idea create this two-sided aspect that both good and bad events can cause divorce. And I said what's less intuitive is the good events. And this again has been tested, not as much as the previous ones. And there's a paper by myself and Bob Willis, and then we filed mild support to this prediction. However, the most destabilizing event is when husband income falls and wife's income rise in unexpectedly. So it's not only good shock versus bad shocks, it's sort of the relative and direction of the shocks to the husband and the shock to the wife. So if the wives get a large positive shock, this is often destabilizing the marriage. And this is not only our finding, it has been also found by others. So shifts in relative power can cause divorce. Empirically, there's a paper by recent paper by Hankins, who looked at the impact of lottery, but he found no effect of winning lottery on divorce. So I think the jury is still out on this problem. As a final comment, what makes the topic of family special is that everyone experienced and has developed his or her own ideas. And you notice that I also add referees included. You will find it when you send papers in family economics. This general familiarity makes people interested in what we do, yet strongly disagree with it. Okay, so you will also find very strong opposition to what you say. And I want to illustrate this from something from my personal experience. I teach family economics in Tel Aviv. I teach it regularly, and I was in class, and some superintendent came to help me with the viewer. And jokingly, I asked him if he would like to teach in my stead. So he looked at me and said, okay, what do you teach? So I said, I teach family economics, and what is the topic? So I thought the topic that I was going to discuss was that men are more likely to marry than women, especially in later ages. You should know that this is a fact, okay? And of course, we have explanation to this via sex ratios, different longevity, and so on. So this is what he told me after I mentioned this idea to him. He said, simple. We need them, they don't need us. Okay? So I don't think this is in Becker, by the way, but it's something that surprised me, and I share it with you. So everyone has his views on the family, and you will discover it when you talk with your wife, with your friends, and so on, but still it's a pleasure to do that. So now I'm moving, this is a shift, I'm moving to the slides that Becker has sent us. And of course, I cannot do justice to everything here, so this will be sort of a very partial presentation. So, just as an introduction, look at the name. The name is The Big Issues in Family Economics. And this sequence of notes will be on fertility and population. In the conference we had in Chicago, there was a somewhat similar group over there. He was a little bit critical of our direction of work because he still thinks that fertility and children is the most important problem in family economics. And we, in many of our models, have no children even in the model, okay? So this is in the same vein, and that's why I called them the big issues. And it starts with noting a couple of facts about fertility, quite a few of them. Decline in fertility, and more out of marriage fertility happens, so this is the line below. This is not only like in the US where very young black women have children at the age of 16. It can also be older women with the new technologies of fertility having children very close to the time, to the last station, when the biological clock starts to speak. So there are many situations here which can create children out of wedlock. Here it looks at the percent single, and we see that starting in 1979, we have more single men and more single women. By the way, this is contrary to what I told you before, to some extent, but if I would continue this to older ages, you would see that there are more single women than single men, okay? But at earlier age, there are more single men than single women, mainly because men marry later. By the way, there's a very little work done, there's only very good paper by Bergstrom, why men marry later than women. Okay, I think this is still a good problem to work on. Now, we know about labor force participation. Maybe less advertised is that men work less over time, women work more. And of course, the main column to look here at the married females who increase much the participation. This is data from Ireland, but it happens everywhere. Okay, so married women have increased the work supply a lot. All men have reduced their labor supply, less understood problem, maybe less relevant to the family economics. Total fertility rates. Here, it starts to shift attention, and this will be throughout the slides, what happened in the big countries in Asia. Because things changed there fairly dramatically, so this is a place which is very much worth looking at. And you see there, in most of the countries here, they are from East Asia, and you see very marked reduction in fertility rates. and countries which had high fertility and now are below the replacement rate, which is here represented by the number 2. So this is sort of the starting of the problem that it tries to address. At the same time, and relatedly, average age of marriage has risen. And again, it has risen fairly sharply, which is also a cause for the reduction in fertility. Eventually, he wants to talk about the role of women education and women independence in all this change in fertility. So here is a table which looks at attitudes, because eventually, as you'll see, we are going to, in this context, look at attitudes and norms when we discuss fertility. So this table is designed to look at the question, how independent is the woman in choosing a partner? This is asked from children and what do they think. But the fact is that in many Eastern countries, women have little, not little, but relatively small influence on who will be her husband. It's often the parents who decide. I noticed that first, when I visited in a house of an Indian, which I rented in Stony Brook, who was a physicist, and by chance I got the Indian newspaper of the United States, and I looked at the advertisement. So an Indian woman will never advertise herself. Her brothers or her parents will say, we have a woman such and such looking for a match. A small puzzle. What do you think was the most important thing said about these women on advertising? What is the most important characteristic? Costas, you should know. Okay, so I'll tell you, having a green card. Okay? A green card, that's very important. Okay. Now, looking at divorce rate, again, they point to 2 points here. First of all, the US is much higher than other countries. Here, it's compared to countries in Asia, but it's also much higher than other countries in Europe. So the US has high divorce rate. You can see at the beginning of the graph, you can see a sharp rise, 70 to 80. This is the decade called the divorce revolution, okay? In this particular decade, divorce rates doubled. And it's a big problem for us economists to explain this. It relates to the problems that we talked about before, the impact of the law. You can see, however, that things which we don't easily explain is why did the divorce rate decline after all? And at the same time, you see that the East country in East Asia start to increase the divorce rate. It was almost non-existent in some of these countries, and now it's getting higher and higher. So this is one of the other things that change in the Orient, the divorce mode. So here is a model that Gary has worked out to explain these changes, especially in Asia. And the components are basically two. One is culture, and one is income. And culture has some peculiarity that it influences. There's some externalities in culture, so my attitudes depend on the culture of society. So there are here externalities. These externalities create reinforcement. Reinforcement can cause multiple equilibria, And it also can lead to situations where relatively small changes cause very large changes. So you can have, as a result, shifts in equilibrium from one equilibrium to another equilibrium, which is our way of talking about big changes. So for those who are not familiar, if you look at the system of equation, Fi is the family structure of particular agent I, and it depends on the current C. The current C is the current culture and his own income. His attitude depends also on the current culture, but it's modified by his income. And then the current culture is the sum of the attitudes of all agents. If you even assume that the effects, individual effects, are relatively small, namely your personal income, a small effect on your family structure, and not so small effect on your character. A small effect on family structure and a small effect of your cultural attitudes. It is still the case that big changes in culture can happen, and this is called the social multiplier, and this you can see in equation 5, where we look at an increase in income. I bar is average income. Increase average income, you can get a large increase in culture because this is the correlation of changes by each of the agents who in turn affect other agents. So it's a standard multiplier idea. This is not new to Becker, and it's fairly familiar in the family economic literature. So how does he apply that? Now, if you look at the data, the largest change in fertility happened in the Asian countries. Now, these same countries had the larger increase, it's not in the graph, in income. Okay? So what we see here is some sort of a multiplier effect. This increase in income that happened created a large decrease in fertility. Now, he also looks carefully at the issue of female education, which is again one of the cultural changes that happened in Southeast Asia. In my visit there in Taiwan, in Hong Kong, one talking with students, these are the people whom I more often meet in academics, you can see really a lot of female graduate students who declare that they are not going to marry. They just don't want to marry, because married there means being in a family under control of husband with relatively old norms, which is not very good for the woman. So they prefer simply not to marry. And this is one of the reasons that happens there, which reduces fertility. So some data on that. First, you look at what we know by now, which was, of course, a surprise to many, is what happens to male and female education in high-income countries. So in high-income countries, women are now more educated than men, that you can see in the two top lines. In the low-income countries, this did not happen, but the education of women and the education of men has risen together. Now, what this table shows, that rise in female education, if you look at the column here, the regression. So the first variable, we regress your fertility rate on education, and TFR is the people who have relatively high education. And you can see that increase in higher education causes a reduction in fertility. Increase in GDP also causes a reduction in fertility. So as Eastern countries have more educated women, fertility declines, and this is kind of the thing we need to think about. What are the implications? So here feels, I think, from reading these slides, that the facts are very well established. We have here a big event. We can explain it to some extent by changing norms. So that's what made it big, okay? Things can happen, but in order for them to be big, you need some kind of reinforcement, and norms is one of them. And what are the implications of lower fertility? What are the consequences in his mind? First of all, there will be, because we have fewer children, we may invest more in them. So this is going back to the quantity-quality interaction. On the macro, you're all aware, basically, in Europe, the huge issue that we have now is financing Social Security, not enough young people to carry on the older population. And this is one important difficulty every country almost faces now in Europe. This may have effect on migration, and even though I'm not sure I completely understand this, the point you're trying to make here. But immigration can, to some extent, mitigate the issue of Social Security as immigrants come and enter the labor force. Sometimes they don't enter the labor force, in which case it will be different. Now, what he's mainly concerned about is what will be the implication of declining population on economic growth. So, in a question mark, do we have constant returns to scale? So is population changing income on a constant returns to scale level? Do we have diminishing returns, as Malthus warned us? Or perhaps we have increasing returns, and as we have in some of the new growth models. Uncharacteristically to Becker, he did not make up his mind yet on this. He says uncharted territory, since world population grew for about 300 years. But nevertheless, he's risking himself here, saying that some population ranges, increasing returns dominate. So if increasing returns dominate, it means that we should be worried about dwindling population sizes, okay? And why does he think about increasing returns? One is sort of economic of scale, higher specialization, division of labor, and things of that nature. Let me add one thought on this here, even though I know next to nothing about this issue, is that I observed that sometimes large poor countries can do big things, okay? Sometimes they can do big bad things. So I'm speaking about atom bombs. I speak about Pakistan, Iran, India, poor countries, yet they were able to make a large research project at the frontier of the technology. Of course, having students coming from the US, educated in the US, always helps, but this is not the issue I'm trying to point out. I'm trying to point out that if you have a large country and you want to achieve something, so even though this is a very poor country, just because it's large, there's enough number of talented people there compared to developed countries. And every one of you is familiar with this country, know about the excellent Indian who come from the better schools, and there are millions of them, okay? So they can do the job if they have enough resources. Now, how does the Indian or Pakistani or Iranian countries have the resources for the atom bomb, even though it's a free country, it's a small, poor countries? It's a large country, and you take a little bit of money from each one of them, and you move it into a particular direction, you still have a lot of money. So the big countries have some advantages that small countries do not have, even if they are poor. This is not exactly returns to scale, but maybe it has some promise as an idea. Okay, I think I can stop here. And that's it. I don't know if I have time or not, but that's all I have to say. Kostas asked here basically about econometrics.
No, it's not about econometrics.
Okay, just a second.
It's whether the macro evidence is really giving us a power to test the theories and whether we have the price variation at the micro level to be able to aggregate up to what we see at the macro level.
All right. So let me phrase the question in terms of social interactions. So we, in this model, culture has an important role, and we want basically somehow to find out whether this is correct or not. Okay, all that Becker showed so far that it can have a big effect, and there are some slides that I show you which are consistent with this, but how would we actually find out? So I think from my little knowledge, and Kostas perhaps can elaborate on this, and I will listen, there's a big problem in identification of such peer effect or reinforcing culture effects, and this is much related to criticism by Mansky, where we say we just don't know if we are influenced by others or everyone is affected by same effect. So it's not so straightforward to test this kind of things, I think, econometrically. I don't know if I answered your question. Mm-hmm. Yes? Shoshana?
We can only second guess what Gary would have said if he was here. And I'm puzzled by the juxtaposition of the table on children's desire to choose own mate with all these other tables. And I'm only guessing that perhaps one of the points that Gary was going to make is in his oral presentation is that in those countries where the response is that there are high percentages of people saying that the family should choose a husband for the woman and not the woman herself. So that includes many parts of the Middle East and India, Bangladesh, and Pakistan. These are also countries where we have not seen as much of a decrease in fertility, or at least the fertility is still quite high. And I'm actually intrigued by seeing that in Mexico and Venezuela and Bolivia and Peru, so we have quite a few Latin American countries in this group, we see that only a small percentage answered that the family should choose the husband for the woman. And from the chart that you see at the end, it looks like fertility has, I mean, maybe there are some people know more about fertility rates. Maybe we can just try to all together guess what Becker would have said, and that there has been more of a drop in fertility, total fertility, where women have more of a say in choosing their husbands.
But you should notice those are new attitudes from 2007, so those are relatively new. The point it tries to make that there was a big change over time in these attitudes. So this is just the remaining. You know. Yes, go on.
I think in terms of the low fertility, declining fertility, that that's a very important distinction, that the problems with pay-as-you-go pension plans and healthcare, for example, are a consequence of declining fertility, of changes in the fertility rate, while the returns to scale issue, it seems to me, raise issues about a steady state where we ask about low fertility versus high fertility. And that's a rather different issue, and I think an important distinction to maintain.
I wanted to, I guess, provide some clarification on the findings about changes in divorce law, and you referred to the upward trend in divorce rates in the United States in the 1970s, and that this constituted a puzzle, and I'm not sure that's really quite fair in the sense that there were a lot of states that did change to pure no-fault divorce systems during that time, and work that I've done and other people have done showed that there were actually, you know, law-related changes in the divorce rate during the 1970s. And I guess also just more generally on the recent work by Wolfers and others, I think there still are fundamental problems with the way in which no-fault divorce is coded in the data, that I think people haven't been as careful necessarily in distinguishing states which have mixed grounds and states which have only no-fault grounds.
Well, I don't know if people were not careful, because I do know that a lot of people worked on that and spent a lot of time and effort in coding and recoding and arguing about that. Maybe the job is not done yet, but I think we've done our best so far. It's not a problem that was sort of pushed aside. It was very provocative and led to a lot of research, and that's what we came up with. I mean, if you want to, for instance, to talk about the endogeneity of the law and what do you learn from state differences in divorce laws and so forth, there's a huge number of issues. But I think Wolfer, I mentioned simply him, he is aware of all these issues and he tried to make his judgment, and that's what I cited.
Okay, thank you very much. I think that we will stop the session now.